So welcome to this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. We're going to do a talk about a Supreme Court case today here on Broadcast Blue. Thanks so much for joining me, whether you're watching live or whether you watch the video, or now I'm actually putting the audio up as well on the Broadcast Blue podcast. So if all you've got time to do is listen to the MP3, you can catch it there as well. Three different ways to catch Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. And so let's go ahead and jump in it today, because we have a Supreme Court case that just came out, the District of Columbia versus Westby. This is the third edition in 2018 of our Case of the Week on Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar series. This Supreme Court decision just came out a couple of days ago. Today's date is January 24th, 2018, and just came out on the 22nd. So it's only been a couple of days since this came out. An interesting case. We have a bunch of them coming out here. Several Supreme Court cases that are going to be coming out over the next few weeks, and I'm going to cover all of them. This one is an interesting case, and it was from the D.C., the District of Columbia Circuit. So let me, if you're not familiar with the case, I guess you could call this the case of peaches. The facts are kind of entertaining. Our key phrases before we get started, we're going to talk about probable cause, what constitutes probable cause, and yet again, on appeal to the Supreme Court, the concept of qualified immunity. Seems we get a lot of those on appeal, and most of them are either from the Ninth Circuit or the D.C. Circuit, it seems to be. But anyway, our key cases for you today, and they're mentioned throughout the webinar: Maryland versus Pringle, Illinois versus Gates, Illinois versus Wardlaw, Reichel versus Howards, Brousseau versus Hagen, Anderson versus Creighton, and Ashcroft versus Al-Kid. Those are the primary cases that are we're going to be talking about in here. So let me just kind of, well, if you're not familiar with the infamous Peaches, and with the case of Peaches, Peaches is the name of a person. Well, there are several complaints that come in complaining about loud music and allegedly illegal activity going on in a house that is supposed to be vacant, theoretically vacant anyway. But there's obviously a number of people in there, a lot of loud music. These were not anonymous complaints, by the way. They were complaints from people who were very willing to leave their name and who they were. In fact, one of the people making a complaint was actually a public official. So these complaints of all this music and stuff going on, the police officers respond to the complaint. They go inside the house, and when they go inside the house, it's nearly barren and in a total state of disarray. And barren to the extent that there wasn't much there. There were a few of the folding aluminum or folding metal chairs that are padded. You can, if you've ever been to a PTO meeting or something, you know, sitting on taking the folding chairs out and setting them out with the little built-in pads on them. There's just a few of those little padded metal folding chairs downstairs. And then upstairs, there is a mattress, and there is all kinds of empty beer bottles and trash. There's a little bit of food in the refrigerator. There's actually snacks and drinks and stuff that are there along with all of the empties as well. But there aren't any boxes of clothing. There aren't any. There's nothing other than basically what I've just told you is in the house. So it's practically barren except for these chairs that are downstairs, which are actually where they've what they refer to as a strip club. They turned this into the downstairs area. There's an area where they had like a strip club going, and then upstairs when they went upstairs, they found the mattress. They also found one woman who was naked. Naked, as Bart Simpson would say, and so they found a naked female upstairs along with several males, and there were packs of condoms spread around, including a used condom that was sitting on a windowsill. So that's kind of the atmosphere that they found when they walked into. They were talking to of two of the women that were in there, and the two women told them that Peaches was the tenant, and that Peaches. They said that one of the women that were there said that the person who owned the place had recently passed away, and that Peaches had just started renting the house from the grandson who had inherited the house from the person who had passed away. Well, they didn't know what Peaches' real name was. All they knew was her name was Peaches. And so they asked, you know, how do we get in touch with Peaches? they one of them had a phone number for Peaches, calls Peaches. They had some difficulty. They're trying to talk to Peaches. Peaches answered the phone and explained that she had just left the party to go to the store. Officer asked her to come back. She refused, said she was afraid of being arrested. They there was a sergeant that was there supervising investigation, spoke with Peaches. First, she claimed she was renting the house from the owner who was fixing it up for her, and she said that she had given the people there permission to be there. But then she said, after becoming evasive and hanging up on him one time, once called back again, she yelled at him, insisted she had permission to be there again, hung up on him again, and then they got through her on the third time. She admitted that she did not have permission to use the home. They contacted the owner of the house. He said that he had trying to be to negotiate a lease with Peaches, but they hadn't reached an agreement. She certainly wasn't a tenant, and she had no legal authority or legal right to be there, and he hadn't given her or anyone else permission to be in the house. And so the police, while they're in there, they've talked to Peaches. They start talking to these partygoers. There's over 20 of them, of people that are in the house. They all have different stories. First off, when the police went in, a lot of these folks ran and hid, which is important when we're talking about whether or not they knew what they were doing was wrong or whether they had permission to be there. They ran and they hid, and they gave different stories. There were some of them said they were at a bachelor party, but no one could identify who the bachelor was, who that was the party was supposed to be for. And so it was really kind of chaotic. So they contact the after they contacted the owner, and he says, "Look, you didn't give permission for anyone to be there." They arrested 21 partygoers, the 21 people who were there for unlawful entry, and they transported them down to the station. Once they were down there, even though they were arrested for unlawful entry, they were actually charged with disorderly conduct, but then eventually the charges were dropped. Well, no good deed goes unpunished. I mean, the charges get dropped. It emboldens them. The 16 of the 21 partygoers decide to sue the district and the five arresting officers for arresting them, stating they sued them for false arrest. They didn't have probable cause to arrest them is the basic argument under the Fourth Amendment and under district law in the District of Columbia, which can be rather complicated to deal with how that works. So they sued the district for false arrest and negligent supervision and sued the officers individually. And so what we have here is a 1983 action on Title 42 of the United States Code, Section 1983. And so there were obviously, when you have a law enforcement officer who is sued and involved in a lawsuit, obviously they're going to try and claim qualified immunity. And so that's kind of the posture of the case. So we got these folks that have been arrested. 16 of them are suing, saying that the officers didn't have probable cause. For the sake of brevity, and it doesn't really matter what happened at the district court level, let me go straight to the circuit court level and let you know what happened with this issue of qualified immunity. Because obviously, when you move for summary judgment for qualified immunity as a matter on a summary judgment, you got to look at the facts most favorable to the non-moving party, which is the plaintiffs, and when you're looking for qualified immunity, when the defendants are. And so they have to look at the facts. And for qualified immunity, I'm going to talk about it just a little bit more in a second. Understand there's two prongs. The first prong is determining whether or not there's been a violation, a constitutional violation, in this case, a Fourth Amendment violation. And the second prong is, if there is a violation, if the court determines there was a violation, was it clearly established at the time? If the answer to either one of those is no, in other words, either it wasn't a violation of the Fourth Amendment or it wasn't clearly established, if the answer to either one is no, then the officers are entitled to qualified immunity as a matter of law. So, and thus it will be proper on a motion for summary judgment. So on appeal, the D.C. Circuit said that there was no probable cause to arrest the partygoers. So they're determining that up front, yes, there was a Fourth Amendment violation. And then when they went to the second question, was it clearly established that what they had was not, the facts they had would not constitute probable cause. The court said that it was established, it was clearly established that under these facts that this would not be probable cause, so that no reasonable officer would think that probable cause existed under these facts, and they used a particular type of analysis in order to reach that conclusion. And as a result, since they determined that it was clearly established under these facts, that the officers were not entitled to a qualified immunity. So it's going up. It's going up, and they ask for cert at the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court granted cert. So it goes up to the Supreme Court, and the issues are, did the officers have probable cause to arrest the people present in the house? In other words, did they have probable cause that the 21 people that they arrested, including the 16 petitioners in there, the 16 plaintiffs in this case, did the officers have a probable cause to arrest them for unlawful presence, unlawful entry into this house? And then second, assuming that the answer to the first question is yes, the second one is, were they entitled to qualified immunity? In other words, was it clearly established? And understand that the courts do not have to answer number one to get to number two. They can go straight to number two without really answering number one. It's not really necessary. If you, there are cases, and we've seen cases, and we had the Mullinex case, Mullinex v. Lunin. We've had a number of, Ashcroft versus Al-Kid. We've had a number of cases where we have qualified immunity type issues. And in a no small number of those cases, the courts will jump straight to the second question. And they will say, even assuming just for argument's sake, without determining it, even assuming just for the sake of argument that this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, was this type of violation clearly established? And they can skip straight to that second question, say, no, it wasn't. So we're going to give them qualified immunity anyway. That you don't have to answer these in any particular order, which makes for some interesting decisions. So let's take a look at a few legal blasts from the past, some controlling law that I've cited for you. This is of Maryland versus Pringle, a 2003 Supreme Court decision. And to determine whether an officer has probable cause for an arrest, we examine the events leading up to the arrest and then decide whether these historical facts viewed from the standpoint of an objectively reasonable police officer. This is another one of your reasonable police officer standards. If that amounts, those facts amount to probable cause it's an objective test, not a subjective test, a lot like use of force. So it's to an objectively reasonable police officer. So would an objectively reasonable police officer presented with these facts believe that there was probable cause to arrest? And that's fundamentally the question in that kind of objective test. And that's Maryland v. Pringle. Let's also, while we're still talking about probable cause, it's important. And, you know, and I get these questions a lot. And when I was teaching Fourth Amendment at FLETC, I got questions on probable cause more than anything else. And there are a number of cases that you can look at that try and make some type of sense out of the concept of probable cause. And some of the decisions, like Texas versus Brown, don't even make any sense. And there's a kind of nonsensical in the way. If you recall the pornography cases from the 70s, I think it was Justice Stewart, I believe, that said, you know, I can't tell you what it is, referring to pornography, but I know it when I see it. Well, probable cause is kind of that way too. We can't really explain, can't give you some type of clear-cut guideline and rule. It deals with probabilities, depends on the totality of the circumstances, and therefore it's not readily or even usefully reduced to a neat set of legal rules. And so basically what the Supreme Court is acknowledging is that, you know, it's a fluid concept. It's kind of hard to hold it in your hands, right? It's very difficult, very dynamic, and it's very, very fact-driven. And under this totality of the circumstances concept, very, very factually driven, you can have cases that are very, very similar except for one or two facts. And those one or two Those one or two facts that are different might be enough under the totality of the circumstances to have a situation where you have probable cause in one but not in the other. So it's a very, it's difficult. It's a very difficult thing to determine, which is why we have so many cases where we look at what it takes to establish probable cause. What does it take for a drug dog to establish probable cause? What does it take for an officer to establish probable cause of a specific type of offense? In this case, what would it take to establish probable cause that these people knew that Peaches did not have the authority to give them permission to be in the house? Because remember, they've been arrested for unlawful entry. And even though they said Peaches told us we could come, Peaches sent us. The whole concept of whether under a totality of the circumstances a reasonable officer could believe that they knew or should have known that they did not have permission to be in there. And so those were a couple probable cause cases. Let's take a look at a couple of qualified immunity cases. And I've talked about this already in the Reichel v. Howard's decision. Officers are entitled to qualified immunity under Section 1983 and Bivens as well if they are federal officers that are involved. They're entitled to qualified immunity under Section 1983 unless they violated a federal statutory or constitutional right that was clearly established at the time they violated it. So it requires both. First, there has to be a violation of this federally protected right, and it has to be clearly established at the time they did it that it was a federally protected right. So that is, and sometimes you get situations to where it violates the Fourth Amendment, but they are nevertheless given qualified immunity because it might be that particular decision is the one that's actually making it clearly established. In fact, if you go all the way back to the very famous use of force case, Tennessee versus Garner, we have 36 states in the nation that had the rule, the statute, state statute that says you could shoot someone just to keep them from getting away. And Supreme Court, Tennessee versus Garner says, no, that's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. But we've just now decided that this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It wasn't clearly established until just now. And so we're going to give the officer qualified immunity anyway, because it wasn't clearly established. So that's the whole concept of how the qualified immunity works. And here's something that's important to the Supreme Court decision as well. What is it that makes it clearly established? And there's been a lot of cases going back and forth and of what it took to be clearly established. Does it have to just be a general rule? Well, generally speaking, this is established law, but it goes further than that. To be clearly established for the purposes of qualified immunity, the existing law has to place the constitutionality of the officer's conduct beyond debate. That means it's clear. It's clearly established. It's not debatable. There are cases that are so similar on their facts. Now, they don't have to be identical, but they have to be so similar in their application to the current case that it puts the constitutionality of the conduct beyond debate. So you've got totality of the circumstances and constitutionality beyond debate. You put those two things together and it's going to kind of set us up for what happens here and what the court kind of did with this. First, let's start with the probable cause, and we're going to the majority opinion. Now, there were two separate concurring opinions that were provided where they concurred in the result, but not in the in the whole rationale. And I'm going to talk about those separately just for a second. But anyway, let me talk first about what the court decided and the ruling and what we can take away from this. First, they addressed the issue of probable cause. So they went through the qualified immunity steps in order. They did not skip straight to step number two. They did step number one, and they went and actually reached a determination on whether or not probable cause existed. And so the Supreme Court said that considering the totality of the circumstances, the officers made an entirely reasonable inference that the partygoers were knowingly taking advantage of a vacant house as a venue for their late night party. And they base this on a two-prong analysis. The first two, when they're looking at under a totality of the circumstances, there were two separate aspects under this that they looked at. First off was the condition of the house itself. There were multiple neighbors that informed the officers that the house had been vacant for months. The house had no furniture except for several padded metal chairs downstairs and the makeshift strip joint and the bare mattress upstairs where who knows what was going on up there. The facts are unclear, but I think we can connect the dots. The rest of the house was empty except for a few fixtures and some large appliances and some food and some snacks. Now, there were signs of inhabitants like working electricity, plumbing, and blinds on the windows, but it's not uncommon. That's not necessarily inconsistent, the court said, with a house being unoccupied. They could have kept the utilities on while a new tenant was coming in. And I know indeed some insurance companies require that you do that when you vacate a house that's insured. And with respect to the food and the toiletries that were found in the kitchen and the bathrooms, that could have been brought by the partygoers for their use. There were no clothes, no boxes, nothing like that. One of the women told the officers that Peaches had recently moved in, but the officers had reason to doubt that was true because there, like I said, there were no boxes or any moving supplies or any clothes in the closet or anything to suggest that someone actually lived there. And then the second, so the condition of the house was the first thing they looked at with all of these facts regarding the condition of the house. And the second thing was the partygoers' conduct. So they arrived at 1 o'clock in the morning. They said the music was so loud it could be heard easily from outside. When they entered the house, there were several officers that smelled marijuana. There were beer bottles, cups of liquor on the floor. The floor was so dirty that one of the women that was actually there refused to sit on. When they told her to sit down, she refused to sit on the floor because it was so dirty. The fact that living room had been converted into a makeshift strip club and that strippers in bras and thongs with cash stuffed in their garter belts were giving lap dances in the living room when they came in. Upstairs, the officers found a group of men with a single naked woman on a bare mattress and along with multiple open condom wrappers, including a used condom. So taken together, the condition of the house and the conduct of the partygoers allowed the officers to make these common sense conclusions about human behavior. Because remember the partygoers' reaction when the officers came in, the fact that some of them fled, two of them hid themselves in closets, others hid themselves in bathrooms. In fact, one of them absolutely refused to come out. So this unprovoked flight upon noticing the police, the court said, is certainly suggestive of wrongdoing and can be treated as suspicious behavior that can factor in under a totality of the circumstances. And this is where they cited the Illinois versus Wardlow case that I referenced earlier up front. So the fact that they said that it was a bachelor party, no one knew who the bachelor was, their answers to questions suggested that they had the guilty state of mind, of the vagueness and implausibility of their stories that were, a lot of them were different and inconsistent with one another. The officers could have reasonably inferred that they were lying and that the lie suggested a guilty mind. And then Peaches as well. Peaches, her lying and evasive behavior gave them to discredit everything that she had told them, including the fact that she said that she told them that she had invited the partygoers there, that she had given them an invitation. And Peaches told us to come. It was Peaches gave us the invitation. And so the court said, viewing the circumstances as a whole, a reasonable officer could conclude that there was probable cause to believe the partygoers knew they did not have permission to be in the house. So the courts disagreed with the circuit court below and said they said the circuit court used an excessively technical dissection of factors supporting probable cause and viewed facts in isolation rather than as a factors in a totality of the circumstances. And you can't view them individually. You have to look at them all together instead of looking at them. Sometimes, remember, the sum is more than just the total of the parts, and that kind of works with probable cause that way. You have to look at all these factors when taken in totality and not just isolate them and look at it. And they also noted that the D.C. Circuit Court mistakenly believed that they could dismiss any circumstances that had an innocent explanation. So there was, you take them in isolation and you look at innocent possible explanations, you're never going to get probable cause. So anyway, the Supreme Court pretty much shot that down. And for those reasons, they reversed the D.C. Circuit Court's holding that the officers lacked probable cause. And they could have stopped there. They said probable cause existed. So what happens with your qualified immunity argument when the court looks at the first prong? What does there have to be? There has to be a violation. In this case, it was a Fourth Amendment violation. They argued there was no probable cause. The Supreme Court says, yes, there was probable cause. And so they could have stopped right there. They could have stopped. The majority in this decision could have stopped right at that point and said, therefore, they're entitled to qualified immunity because there was no violation. In fact, it's more than just being entitled to qualified immunity. If they're making a decision as a matter of law that probable cause existed, there's no constitutional violation to predicate the suit upon. And so a dismissal is more warranted than anything else. But without getting too technical in that regard, they say probable cause existed, and they could have stopped right there and granted the qualified immunity, reversed them just on that grounds. But they didn't. They went on. And they decided to take a look at the qualified immunity angle, even though they didn't have to. And it's important because the circuit court, the District of Columbia Circuit Court, erred in applying the test for qualified immunity. And apparently, the majority was felt so strongly about it that they felt like they needed to address it. And because there's been a lot of cases to where and it following from 2011 on, where the court's been really adamant about what it takes to establish this qualified immunity, this whole concept of being clearly established and being beyond debate, and that the existing law must have been constitutional beyond debate. That comes from the Al Kidd decision in 2011. So the court said, look, to be clearly established, a legal principle must have been sufficiently clear under then existing precedents. It has to be well settled law. And it requires that the legal principle clearly prohibit the officer's conduct in particular circumstances before him. And they also cite a few cases that I didn't, some very important Supreme Court cases. I've talked about Saussure versus Katz before, that 2001 decision, and I've made several references already to the Mullinex v. Luna case, which just came out a couple of years ago in 2015, with the shooting at the car from the overpass, the LEO shooting at the car. Which is a very, very good decision to read. If you're not familiar with the Mullinex v. Luna 2015 case, I highly recommend that to you. But anyway, so the court says, look, we have repeatedly stressed that the courts must not define clearly established law at a high level of generality, since if you doing so avoids the crucial questions to whether they acted reasonable in the particular circumstances that he or she faced. And a rule is too general if the unlawfulness of the conduct does not follow immediately from the conclusion that the rule was firmly established. And the court just basically, the Supreme Court, in citing a lot of the cases that I provided for you in the front, said that, look, at the circuit court level, they just did not follow this straightforward analysis, which is probably a reading between the lines. That's a pretty big slam. They did not have to make a determination on the qualified immunity issue once they determined probable cause existed. But for them to go on and fully expound upon what is required for qualified immunity and then to state affirmatively in the first sentence of Part B of page 16 of the decision, the panel majority did not follow this straightforward analysis. It instead reasoned that under clearly established district law, a suspect's good purpose and bona fide belief of the rights to enter vitiates probable cause to arrest for unlawful entry. And so they say, by treating the invitation as uncontroverted evidence, they assumed the officers could not infer from their intent any other circumstances, and that this was just flat out wrong. And so the court spends a good amount of it, the opinion, talking about, you know, the significance of what it takes to be clearly established and the requirement, what you have to have, and what it takes to be beyond the debate, kind of saying, hey, look, we said it in 2011, we said it in 2015, and now we're saying it again. You've got to, this is the test, and this is the way that it works. And, you know, you might not like it, some of the circuit courts, especially the D.C. and the Ninth Circuits, but it is what it is. And so you need to take it at face value. So that was a very interesting second part, wholly unnecessary, but basically they reversed the D.C. Circuit Court on both counts. Now, there was a concurring opinion. Justice Sotomayor concurred in part and concurred in the judgment. And what Justice Sotomayor did was what happens in in a lot of these other cases where they skipped the second prong. Justice Sotomayor said, hey, look, this was a very fact-intensive case, and there were a whole lot of circumstances, a whole lot of facts going on, and the lower courts are far better prepared to answer those types of fact-based questions than we are, and it's wholly unnecessary because the circuit court erred in applying the test for qualified immunity. And even if you assume that probable cause did not exist, it's not clearly established, and so they're entitled to qualified immunity. So Justice Sotomayor would have skipped the whole analysis on whether or not probable cause existed and just gone straight to the second prong and said, even if there isn't probable cause, it's not clearly established, and so they get qualified immunity. And so in a very short one-page concurring opinion, she says, I just think it's unnecessary for us. She disagrees with the majority's decision to reach the merits of the probable cause question. And it's not necessary, and she would just apply the second prong, and therefore she concurs in the judgment. And then separately, Justice Ginsburg concurred in the judgment in part for reasons that are always interesting to read what she has to say. But anyway, so some of the folks have said this was a unanimous decision, that they said the court, I was reading one article in some online legal news source saying that the judges unanimously determined that there was probable cause, and that's not true. They unanimously would have concurred in the con of applying the qualified immunity, but only seven of the nine would have determined that there was actually probable cause. And that's enough. I mean, that's a majority. Gosh, that's more than we usually get when we have some of these split decisions like that. But anyway, that's the rule of law. So now we do have what can establish probable cause in this situation. So they actually answered that question, which is always good for us because it gives us something to go by. And since it's so hard to define what probable cause is, it's very important to have cases where they don't skip the first question. They actually make the determination as to what constitutes probable cause. So this was a good decision all the way around for the government, for law enforcement. We have some guidance now with establishing probable cause in this particular type of circumstances and facts, what it takes to have permission to be in a vacant house and to be to where you're not liable criminally for criminal trespass. And again, a reiteration of what they've been saying, the court's been saying for the last 7 years regarding qualified immunity all the way back to the Ashcroft versus Alkid decision. And there you have it. So got some more Supreme Court decisions. You know, what's up with this qualified immunity? What's going on with this of these cases? And why do we keep getting cases from the circuit courts that seem to question, hey, did the Supreme Court really say this? Maybe we don't think they said what it seems like they said, and then we We're getting a lot of these qualified immunity cases, and we get again, we get a lot of them from there are obviously a lot of them from the Ninth Circuit, a number of cases from the Ninth Circuit, but we from other circuits as well, and it's good to keep an eye. Let's see what kind of impact this decision has now on these qualified immunity decisions, which are very difficult. Remember, qualified immunity, if there's any issue of material fact, you're not going to get that motion for summary judgment because if there's a question of fact that has to be answered, then it's not going to be proper to determine it as a matter of law on a motion for summary judgment for qualified immunity. So kind of see what's going on with that. And we have some really neat cases that are coming out. I'm going to be back for more of these Supreme Court decisions, hopefully the Carpenter case coming out pretty soon. And it'll be guaranteed it'll be on a brown bag the week that they pop out. You'll hear it here first. Thanks so much for joining me on this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday. Don't forget to check out the Broadcast Blue podcast. And you can go to www.broadcast.blue for information on that. More information on upcoming webinars, how to subscribe to the Broadcast Blue podcast on iTunes and Google Play, how to stream the Brown Bag webinar videos that are recorded. If you want to watch previous episodes of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday, you can do that at www.brownbag.video. That's our Vimeo channel, and you can check it out there. And you can listen to the audio, the MP3s that are put onto the Broadcast Blue podcast, absolutely free to listen to the MP3s for each of these. Thanks so much for joining me. I hope to see you again real soon.